Judge, jury, and executioner. Every Tuesday, President Obama gathers with 24 security officials in the White House Situation Room to nominate candidates for assassination by unmanned drones. According to the New York Times, the president personally approves which people will find themselves on the so-called kill list and which ones won't. Nothing like this program has existed before, and almost no one is challenging it. Karen Greenberg directs the Center on National Security at Fordham University's School of Law. An expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties, she's the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, and The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib. Pardis Cabrier is a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where she represents Guantanamo detainees. She was also a lawyer for the father of Anwar al-Awlaki, the first American citizen to be placed on a kill list and assassinated by a U.S. drone strike. Welcome, both of you, to Sounds of Dissent.
Thank you.
Hi there.
Joe Becker and Scott Shane's piece in the New York Times on Tuesday treats this practice of targeted killings as though it were some kind of a secret, but we've been hearing press reports for some time about this. Pardis Cabrier, you work with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and your organization represented the father of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the first American citizen to be targeted and killed by a drone strike. When did you hear about the existence of a kill list?
There have been reports about this program, this targeted killing program by the United States, at least as it's been carried out in Pakistan going back to at least 2009. So there was an article by Jane Mayer in the New Yorker at that time that talked about a U.S. drone strike against an individual there back then. But our case came about, a case brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union, following the reported authorization of to kill a U.S. citizen in Yemen, Anwar al-Awlaki, and that was reported by the New York Times and the Washington Post and major papers in January of 2010. And indeed, it talked about al-Awlaki being put on a secret kill list maintained by the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command, which is a covert unit of the military. And it described back then, those articles talked about in less detail, but secret kill lists that basically authorized his killing in advance. And indeed, a year later, or a year and a half later, the killing was carried out. Al-Awlaki was killed along with another U.S. citizen in September of 2011.
How did the father find out that his son was on a kill list, and how did you get approached? How did your organization get approached to represent him?
I think he, Nasser al-Awlaki, the father, and our client found out like the rest of us through the press. And there was, back then, very, very little information. I have to say what's been good is that there's been more information. There's been a real push for more transparency and more information about what the United States is doing and about this killing policy. And I think sort of peaked with this article we saw last week by Scott Shane and Joe Becker in the New York Times. But I think what's come out has sort of confirmed our worst fears about exactly what this program is and what it's doing. So I think we need to start challenging the substance of the policy and talking less at this point about transparency, although there is much more that we need to know. But I think at this point there's quite a bit that we do know. But going back to our case, Nasser, found out through the papers like the rest of us, and we contacted him and understood that he wanted legal help to challenge the authorization. His son is a U.S. citizen. He believes that if he had done anything wrong and if the United States had evidence against his son, that he should be charged and tried and sentenced in a court of law if he had indeed committed a crime. And that was his basic request, and that was our point in court as well.
How did we get to this point? The use of unmanned aircraft or drones to strike distant targets was initially portrayed in the press as a kind of war-fighting strategy against al-Qaeda in remote regions of Afghanistan. But over time, it's morphed into targeted killings, first of foreign terrorists or suspected terrorists, and then last October, American citizens like Anwar al-Awlaki. Karen Greenberg, how did we get here?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a very large question. But the idea of targeted killings, which this administration does not want to call assassinations, has actually been part of the potential toolbox in the war on terror since the early years after 9/11. How it actually came into policy was slowly and over time, and by 2008, we knew that that it was a useful tool or considered such by the Bush administration. When President Obama came into power, he made the use of drones a priority. And he did this in part on the theory that it would save human lives, particularly the lives of American troops. But there's a lingering suspicion, and it was brought up in the New York Times article you referred to, that it was also just easier than having to deal with the legal morass that has developed around trying to capture, charge, try, detain terrorists. And so there are many pieces to this, but that in broad outline is partially, I think, how it came about. It seems to be in the eyes of the people who defend it, efficient, that it costs less lives. At first, when President Obama employed this policy, they were heavily criticized for the amount of civilian casualties that accompanied these so-called targeted killings. The Obama administration has gone to great lengths to convince the public that these are individually targeted people, and that they have had a good success rate at avoiding civilian casualties. But as that article and other articles have pointed out, the category of who decides what a civilian casualty is has been somewhat twisted by the Obama administration so that they can include in that non-civilian casualties, for example, males of military age. And so there's a tremendous amount of discomfort about what actually the cost of this policy has been in terms of human lives, not just in terms of the legal ramifications of it.
Yes, I'd like to talk about the justifications that have been offered. There's been some attempt to set out legal justification for the use of target for this process that the administration goes through, that President Obama personally selects people who are to be added to this so-called kill list. There was a speech, Attorney General Holder gave a speech about a month ago at Northwestern University where he attempted to lay out this criteria. And the article, also the New York Times article, refers to a legal memo by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Of course, this memo has been kept secret. It's never been released to the public. But they're suggesting that any due process guarantees in the Constitution, which would apply to American citizens, at least, who are targeted, were satisfied by the internal deliberations of the executive branch. Pardis Cabrier, what do you think?
I think that's an astounding position for the Obama administration to take, that the sort of weekly meetings and conference calls that were described in the New York Times article are a substitute for judicial review of the evidence the government may have and the standards that it's using to kill people. It's not at all a substitute. The position the administration has consistently taken and the position they took in court in our case was that the courts do not, they should not have a role in this process, and that it would be inappropriate for them to interfere with the judgment of the executive branch. Separate from our legal arguments, I think it's a terrifying proposition to allow this program to rest entirely within the executive branch. And the administration has said, well, it's not like there aren't checks on the process. We report to Congress. There's at least that. But I think, even when you look at the reporting that happens to Congress, it's to specific and limited committees, intelligence committees and armed forces committees within Congress. They're to Congress people who have security clearance. It's not like the vast majority of lawmakers actually receive information about this program. So it's not, if you talk to people who know about the reporting, it's not robust and it's not coherent. And the vast majority of elected officials do not have information about this program. So it's not a meaningful check. There's no meaningful check in that branch of government. The public is getting more information about the program, but selectively. So we're given bits and pieces and excerpts of a memo where the program is described through this article, but we still don't know the criteria the government uses to decide who it can kill. We don't know who has been killed. We know, individual names that the administration decides to leak to the press, but we don't know who has been killed. We know that 2,000 to 3,000 people have been killed, but who they are, why they were killed, where exactly they were killed, we don't know. And there's just a great deal of information that we still need to know, and that the public debate has been sort of distorted and skewed and unable to be really full and meaningful, I think, because we don't know the full scope of the program. So there's no check that way either. And the administration has canceled out the judicial check. So again, effectively, you have this global killing program that's been operating for, President Obama's term and seems to just be escalating fully within, entirely within the executive branch.
What about the laws of war? Here I'm thinking of this procedure applied to enemy combatants. A hypothetical might be if an American citizen had joined foreign forces in hostilities against U.S. troops in some declared war or some other war like Vietnam, did the government have the right to execute him?
Even accepting a law of war paradigm, and CCR's position is that what we're talking about with respect to killings that are happening in Yemen, for example, are not within a war paradigm. They are killings that are outside the scope of armed conflict. But putting that question aside, and even accepting that we're talking about a global war and the laws of war apply, there are still limitations on who you can kill and when you can kill. And if there's a principle that the administration itself articulated, Attorney General Holder, so there's a principle of, there's four principles, just one of necessity, there's one of distinction, it means that there have to be, criteria that are satisfied in terms of what kind of conduct that person is engaging in that makes that person chargeable. There's a principle of proportionality, so you have to look at civilians, innocent civilians who might be killed, and sort of weigh the costs and benefits that way. And there's a principle of humanity, which basically means that, if capture is possible, killing should really be a last resort. So there are principles that circumscribe the use of lethal force even within war. And those principles, we don't know exactly how they're being interpreted within this program. But our position, our primary position, is that actually we're not talking about war here, but it is. There are legal reasons for that, and there are, I think, good policy and moral reasons to push back against this concept of, authority to use drones and military force, lethal force, to be able to kill people globally, wherever they may be found. There's a lot of concern about that. There are legal reasons to push back against that, and I think there are very good policy and moral reasons to push back against that.
There was a time when, in U.S. history, when the assassination of foreign leaders by the CIA was a fairly regular feature of U.S. covert action abroad, and Congress ended that policy, or that practice, or at least attempted to end it in the 1970s after it was exposed publicly and there was significant public outcry. What happened here? What's happening to international custom? What happened to the U.S. ban on such actions? And how do we square this with, how do we square this policy with with a president who came into office, committed to close Guantanamo, ban the use of torture in interrogating prisoners, close so-called black sites or secret prisons. Karen Greenberg, how do you square that, and what happened to prior positions? What about this policy of assassination in the context of U.S. practice throughout history?
You know, I think I want to follow up in answering this question on something Pardis said, which is that, you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights and others who oppose this policy are really want to take the stand that it's wrong to use the war paradigm, and that that's the justification under which the executive has wrapped itself in secrecy and the privilege of making their own decisions internally and without any kind of transparency. Or sufficient transparency. And actually, this is an important point in what you're talking about. What the administration claims is that they are in the middle of a hot war. And so in a way, the things you're talking about, which much more have to do with a Cold War and are sort of fall in an acceptable category to some of covert operations, almost doesn't apply here. Yes, we may have had this in the past, but what President Obama's done is take this out of the box of what you're referring to as covert behavior and really putting it in a national security policy box, which is quite dangerous, and I'm sure people don't like the analogy, but it's exactly what happened with torture. Torture was something that was, you know, the CIA did, and people ignored it as much as they could. Some did, some didn't. But once it got appropriated by the government itself, it became a whole other problem of much faster scale and, in fact, of much greater power. That's what the worry is with the use of a drone policy that is vetted among a very few group of people. The problem with, you know, the shock of having Obama, who rode into office on a anti-war on terror agenda and who promised so much at the very beginning, what the administration officials would say is they were idealistic before they came into office and they became pragmatic when they came into office, and that the pragmatism of the war on terror they hadn't quite figured would lead them to embrace within 6 months of taking office indefinite detention, and would lead them within a year to the predator drone policy, the targeted killing policy that we see now. The big problem with that is not just that you have a person who literally has changed his mind, President Obama, in terms of what the best strategy for the war on terror is, but what the threshold is now for a new president, because basically what happens when you empower the executive branch and the individuals in it in this particular way is, in losing control over one group, you also lose control over who else might come in. And right now, when we're on the eve of a presidential election, I think this is probably on many people's minds. So it's the idea of transparency has two parts of it that I think are important. One is what you've both referred to earlier as, you know, what did this memo say about targeted assassination or targeted killings? What did it say? What were the premises? How do they account for themselves within a legal regime? But the other part of it is transparency of the process. How are these decisions made? What are the criteria by which these decisions are made? How does it pass from person to person? What are the trade-offs that are made? How do they square this with understanding sovereignty of other countries where these individuals are located? And of course, the question you referred to before, how did they distinguish, if they distinguish Americans from non-Americans in terms of what kind of procedural concerns there are? And all of this goes by the wayside. And I think one of the most interesting things is how little pushback. Pardis's organization is one of a handful of organizations that are pushing back on this. And I don't know how Pardis feels about it, but do you feel sort of alone in this, or do you feel that there's a growing constituency? I'm very interested in that. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Karen, you're right. You know, a year, 2 years ago, I guess, when we brought the Al-Awlaki case with the ACLU, we were really very, very much in the minority in terms of other human rights organizations that, you know, condemned a global detention policy under President Bush, but were very silent on the notion of a killing policy that would extend to a place like Yemen where the United States is not at war. I think now there's been at least a certain consensus on the point of transparency that we need to know more about the legal justification for what's happening. We need to know, you know, who is being killed, what the scope of it is. So there's, I think, greater consensus on that point, but I think it's still a limited consensus or a limited number of people. But you know, and again, when it comes to, again, the substantive issues in terms of, you know, where the policy is being killed out and whether the president has the authority that's being claimed or not, again, I think that I suspect CCR is still very much in the minority on that issue.
I'd like to say something about, or I'd like my guest to say something about the coverage, this article and the response to it. The headline of this kind of extraordinary piece, it's quite long, in the New York Times on Tuesday read, "Secret Kill List Proves a Test of President's Principles and Will." It portrays a president as taking almost a kind of moral high ground in his willingness to assume personal responsibility for making the final determination on who should be assassinated, which is, of course, unprecedented. What do you make of this? What do you make of this sort of portrayal of the president? And where? What about the lack of outrage that we're seeing or not seeing?
Well, I think you know, President Obama is described by his associates and by the media in general as, you know, tremendously thoughtful and considers what's said to him, and that's part of what's going on in that headline, which is that, you know, this is a man who's not doing something in immediate reaction. He's not doing something without thinking about it, and somehow in the description of it as thoughtful, he gets a little bit of a pass. And I think the outrage has partially to do with that. It has partially to do with the fact that he is the Democratic candidate and the Democratic president. I mean, this is a very tough time to get people to oppose Obama in the given the political climate and given the fear of the Republicans taking over the White House. So I think the politics plays into the lack of a reaction. And I think people are somewhat shocked also by understanding who Obama is. And, it wasn't just the killing of Osama bin Laden. It's been all these other killings, including the American citizens. And I think it's going to take a while to absorb what people are now learning, which is this very considering a thoughtful constitutional law professor individual has made a calculation in which killing is easier than relying on processes both legally sanctioned and on legal processes. And I think in part it's going to take a while to integrate this into most citizens thinking about their president.
Well, of course it's easier to kill people than give them due process. I mean, we're substituting the principle of guilty until proven innocent here. There's a piece posted on May 30th by Robert Scheer in Truthdig, and he actually takes quite a strong issue with the portrayal, with the New York Times article itself, saying that, noting that the presence of children on this kill list and saying those children are presumed guilty by virtue of proximity. In other words, they're in the strike zone or they're hanging around in areas where known where Al-Qaeda operates or something along those lines. He says the Times plays along, not even modifying a targeted terrorist with the word alleged, which had once been the paper's convention. And it's what do you think about that? Either one of you, you want to start, Cal Greenberg, and jump in, Pardis, too.
Yeah, I think this is the thing. Okay, the thing that needs to be said at the outset here is that all of this language about are they alleged, are they not alleged, are they guilty, are they not guilty, do we have to make qualitative decisions, or can we have guilt by association, is that enough, goes way back, at least to the beginning of Guantanamo, where there was a question where it would be said along the course of the way by politicians, by policymakers, you know, they were there. They're guilty. And there's a sense that if you're hanging out in a place where they're training terrorists or where you know terrorists to be, that therefore you are guilty because they're so careful about who they let in that de facto you are. However, you cannot extend that to children. Obama was quoted in the article, I believe, as saying, you know, how old are these people? And if they're children, that's really a whole other category, and we need to think about that.
He didn't say we need to think about it. He said it means that Al-Qaeda is entering a new phase because they're using children.
That's, is that what he said?
Yes. So that's a little disturbing. But Pardis, your organization, you yourself have represented people in Guantanamo. Proximity landed people in Guantanamo. Some 600 people were presumed to be the worst of the worst. How did that pan out in Guantanamo?
Right. I think people know. I mean, back when Guantanamo first opened, you had, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and Bush and executive officials saying we had the worst of the worst, dangerous terrorists, you know, people who were committed to bringing down planes. Hundreds of those kinds of people held in Guantanamo, and the public was told to, you know, to trust that kind of, trust those officials, that we were in a time of war. We were obviously much closer to 9/11. There was no process or scrutiny at all allowed or happening for the first few years, and nearly 800 people were held virtually incommunicado for the beginning of Guantanamo. And it was only after Supreme Court cases and after the prison broke open and lawyers started going down and more information began coming out and there was scrutiny enabled, that we now know that the vast majority actually their detention was not supported. They didn't belong in Guantanamo. We know that from what the courts have said, and we know that from releases by the Bush administration itself. You know, hundreds of people were released once the courts got involved and there was outside scrutiny. So that's how Guantanamo's ended. I mean, of course, it hasn't ended. Actually, there's still nearly 170 people there. The policy of indefinite detention is still very much alive and well, but there were at least hundreds of people who have been released. And when you compare that with killing policy, there's obviously no recourse. You've got, you know, irreparable harm. You've got dead people whose families may be able to bring cases, damages cases, but who will never get their lives back. I think that the Guantanamo example is an important one to think about and to think about the outrage. And that was said in this article, and others have made this point. There was global condemnation, and there was, in this country at a certain point, a majority of the public that was opposed to Guantanamo and that detention policy. And now we're effectively talking about a killing policy that includes U.S. citizens, and there's you know, a great deal of silence.
And includes children. I just want to read from the article since we just mentioned it. The article, this is Joe Becker and Scott Chain's piece in the New York Times on Tuesday, speaking about the presence of children in this possibility, these mugshots and brief biographies. According to the article, how old are these people? President Obama asked, according to two officials present. Then he said, if they are starting to use children, he said, of Al-Qaeda, we are moving into a whole different phase, unquote. So now we've got these decisions. We're supposed to be a government of laws, not of men. So if we put this policy and make it legally defensible, the next president can use it too. People may, Obama seems to have a lot of people's trust, which to me is belied by certain realities in terms of other policies, which maybe, Karen, you can say something about. But the next president may not be Obama. And this is the policy that's in place.
No, I think that's right. It's quite terrifying if you think about it. People obviously don't want to think about it. I think the point that, you know, we let 600 plus people out of Guantanamo, most under the Bush administration, that realized they didn't need to be detained, is a warning sign about how well we go about our business of deciding who the enemy is. We've given this power to the president, that he and his close advisors can determine who our enemies are. in an age of shifting enemies that don't just have to do with Al-Qaeda, this is a tremendously powerful thing to have done. And but you know, I don't mind focusing on the predator policy, but I think it's a much larger issue that's been present since the beginning of the war on terror, which is, who is the enemy? Who gets to decide who that enemy is? And then, how are they going to be treated? But the threshold question of who's determining who our enemy is one of the deepest problems of that's revealed by the Scott Chain article.
And that enemy is now increasingly including American citizens, right?
Well, it could. And I mean, it has in terms of the predator policy for sure. You know, we know of these three deaths, these three killings. But we know so little about this policy and about its effect. We don't know the numbers of who's been killed at all. We don't know the names of who's been killed. And so, you know, the issue of transparency here, I think Pardis is right. You don't have to have the issue to know everything to push back and to begin to push back aggressively. But you do eventually need to know what your country has done around the world, because as a recruiting tool, you know, there was a lot of noise about, well, torture is a recruiting tool, and Guantanamo is a recruiting tool, and Iraq is a recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda. But this policy, equal to the others, if not more so, has really come up time and time again within recruitment and statements of people who have been convicted of terrorism about the predator policy and the damage it's caused on their families, on their countries. And so it's something to think about.
One other point I just want to make about this policy, you know, we've focused really on this, on the policy, the aspect of it that has to do with people being put on lists where actual people and their names and their identities are debated. There's some background information, you know, at a meeting that happens every Tuesday or every week among national security officials. But the vast majority of killings actually in Pakistan, and this authority has now been granted in Yemen, are strikes that are called signature strikes. They're strikes with people who we don't know. We don't know their names. We don't know their backgrounds. The government doesn't know who they are. They're targeted and killed based on information that a drone hovering above them has gleaned based on their patterns of behavior. So the majority of people who've actually been killed so far in Pakistan, and as I said, this authority did not exist at the beginning in Yemen, but it was recently approved for Yemen, doesn't even have to do with this minimal process of listing people that we've been talking about. It has to do with just patterns of behavior that are determined in the moment and killing the people whose names and identities the government doesn't even know.
Patterns. Signature killings being activities have been detected that indicate a terrorist signature on them. That's what you're referring to, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, they're called signature strikes.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to end it right here. We're out of time. I want to thank both of you for showing up on our program today and speaking with our audience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a real pleasure. We've been speaking with Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, and with Pardis Kebriyai, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's represented some of the Guantanamo detainees. We've been speaking with them about President Obama's personal involvement in selecting targets for drone strikes, human beings, every Tuesday on so-called Terror Tuesdays. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.